I wonder how many of us, as we were driving to worship this evening, or maybe even this morning, thought something like this. Who am I? Who am I that I can come into God's presence and sing songs and say prayers and God will accept me? Who am I that I can come before God and have Him accept me and my worship, my songs of praise, my prayers, and things like that? After all, the Bible says that God is light and in Him is no darkness at all. And He dwells in inapproachable light. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 16. When holy men in the Bible entered into the presence of God, they sometimes bowed all the way down to the ground with their face to the ground and covered their face because they understood they were unworthy to enter into the presence of God. And so, who am I that I can assemble together with people like me, sinful people, people that have fallen short of God's glory, and expect God to receive my worship? Or, what kind of person should I be? Should I strive to become so that God will accept my worship and will accept my praise? I wonder if we don't take it for granted that God is going to accept our worship. We go on Sunday morning and we're there on Sunday night and Wednesday night and during gospel meetings, by the way, which we have one coming up here in 2 weeks, and we just expect God to accept our praise. We take it for granted that we will. I wonder if we're so arrogant that we assume God will be pleased with our efforts no matter how casually and haphazardly they're offered to them. And so we give little thought to it. We make no preparations for it. We examine ourselves very little. We come and we offer, you know, some songs sort of haphazardly sung and casually sung. And we say, well, God, surely God is going to accept that. I wonder if our come as you are culture has affected us to the point that we're offended if someone has the audacity to suggest that we ought to prepare ourselves for worship. You know, we live it. Just come as you are. And who are you to suggest that I ought to prepare for worship and get myself ready for worship? No, I don't mean just in the clothes we wear. I mean in the character that we've developed, in the character that we possess. And then that raises the question that the psalm that we're going to look at raises tonight, the 15th psalm. Who is fit to approach God in worship? Who is fit to approach God in worship? And so the 15th psalm is it's a short psalm. It's brief, but it's dense with content. And so let's take a look at it. Just 5 verses. We'll read through it and then we'll make some comment on it. O Lord, who may abide in your tent? Who may dwell on your holy hill? He who walks with integrity and works righteousness and speaks truth in his heart. He does not slander with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his friend. In whose eyes a reprobate is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord. He swears to his own hurt and does not change. He does not put out his money at interest, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things will never be shaken. We can categorize this psalm as a wisdom psalm. Remember in the very beginning of our study of the book of Psalms, or taking our sermons from the book of Psalms, we suggested there are several categories of psalms. There are royal psalms, and there are wisdom songs, there are personal laments, and so just various categories. There are more than that. We can maybe consider this one a wisdom psalm because it gives us practical guidance in living the kind of life that will please God. And so if you want to please God, if you want to be acceptable to God, this is the kind of life that we should live. Some have speculated that this may have been sung by people who are on their way to Jerusalem to worship God, maybe on one of the feast days. And as they're approaching Jerusalem, they sing this song. Who may sojourn or abide in your tent, and who may dwell on your holy hill? It can be divided up into three sections. There's the opening question, verse 1. And then you have the body of the psalm, verses 2 down through the next to the last line. And then the last line states a promise to those who develop the kind of character that's described here in the body of the psalm. The message is, we should prepare ourselves to enter into God's presence for worship by developing the kind of character He approves of. But there's a wider application than that, I think. Since we are always in the presence of God, we should develop this character so that we might always be acceptable to Him. And so he talks about approaching God's holy hill or dwelling in His tent. But there's a broader application. We're always in the presence of God. We're always before Him. And so in order to be acceptable to Him and maintain that fellowship with Him, we need to develop this kind of character. And so let's just take it apart section by section, three sections of unequal length, and make some comment about this and devote our attention to this psalm in that way tonight. The opening question again, O Lord, O Jehovah, who may abide in your tent? Who may dwell on your holy hill? God's tent is a reference to the tabernacle. You remember in the beginning of Israel's history, God gave them instructions to make a tent, to build a tent where His presence would be, sort of a dwelling place of God, although we understand that God cannot be confined to any one location, to any building or any tent like this. But it would be the place where God met man. They were divided into two sections. There's an outer section, the holy place, where the priest would go in daily and serve before God on behalf of the people. And then, of course, there's the most holy place, the inner room, where once a year the high priest would take blood on the Day of Atonement to atone for the sins of all the people. And so this is the tent. This is God's tent. This is His dwelling place, as it were. And when the tent was, instructions for the building of the tent were given and the tent was finally constructed, well, then the presence of God filled the tent. Look at the very end of the book of Exodus, verses 34 and following. The cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And so the presence of God is so overwhelming and so overpowering that Moses can't even go in. And so that's the tent of God that David's wondering about. Now, who might sojourn in God's tent, or who might dwell in God's tent? Who might approach the tabernacle in order to worship God? God's holy hill is the Temple Mount. Remember, Jerusalem was built on several hills. Mount Zion was one of those, the hill where the fortress of David was. And remember, we've talked about that before, how Zion, the fortress of David, the fortress of God, becomes a symbol for God's protection and provision. And eventually the word Zion, the name Zion, comes to be practically synonymous with the holy city itself, as the city of Jerusalem, where God's temple was, where God's dwelling place was. The Temple Mount is another one of the hills or the mountains upon which Jerusalem is built. This is Mount Moriah. You remember Mount Moriah. You might remember Genesis chapter 22, where God tells Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, his son, on Mount Moriah. That's where the temple eventually was built. It's also the place where David makes a sacrifice to stop the plague that is spreading through Israel. And so that's Mount Moriah. 2 Chronicles chapter 3 and verse 1 is the reference on that. And so this is God's holy hill or God's holy mountain where the temple is, or the tabernacle is before the temple was built. And so who might approach God in His tent? Who might come into the presence of God on His holy mountain? And so we think about these pilgrims who went to Jerusalem maybe for one of the feast days. No doubt many of them would think, let's stay as close to the temple as we can. Well, who's fit to do that? Now, who's qualified to stay as a worshiper of God on God's holy mountain in the presence of His tent? The first verb, the verb abide, might be translated sojourn in the Bible that you use, but it reminds us that we are sojourners and pilgrims in our lifetime. That reminds us of 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 11. Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles. And so we're sojourners and pilgrims in this world. We're here just passing through. We're here only temporarily. But we're here before God hoping that we'll inherit a more permanent home after this life is over. And so we want to spend our time here in God's presence, not only in worship, but always. We'll spend our time in fellowship with God, not only in worship, but always. And so that's the question. Who is fit to dwell before God? Who is fit to come before Him in worship? And who will be acceptable to God? Well, what we have in the following verses are 10 characteristics that describe the kind of person that God will accept. And we'll just take a look at each one of those. Well, I don't usually have 10 or 12 points in a sermon. I usually only develop 3 or 4. So we won't be able to spend very much time on any one of these, but hopefully we'll be able to spend enough time that we'll be able to appreciate what the writer has to say. Some of these characteristics are positive, and some of these characteristics are negative. And so we'll talk about that as we go through. The first three are rather general in nature. They sort of lay the foundation for the specific kinds of behavior. And these have to do with behavior, our behavior, not just our attitude or not in a principled sort of way, our character, although that's addressed. But a lot of these have to do with what we do or our behavior. The first three give sort of a general summary of the kind of behavior God desires in His people. And then the other characteristics can be maybe generalized into broad categories. The man that God accepts is honest. He controls his tongue. He doesn't take advantage of other people. Rather, he treats them well. He has a high regard for those who do right. He has no patience with the ungodly. And so those are sort of general principle, general categories into which these specific statements might be placed. So let's just take a look at each one of them. We're going to look at the first three together as broad principles that lay the foundation for our character, and they ought to produce the kind of behavior that will enable God to accept us. So who may dwell, who may abide in God's tent, who may dwell in your holy hill? He who walks with integrity and works righteousness and speaks truth in his heart. So let's just talk. Now your version might read a little bit different than that. It might say something like the one who walks with in blamelessness or something like that. But that's the idea. The idea of integrity is to be complete and sound and whole and blameless, sincere and innocent. What is ethically sound and upright. It has to do with the absence of moral defect. And so a person who walks in integrity, well, he doesn't have moral defect, does he? So it has to do with the absence of moral defect like pride or greed or envy, anger, malice, selfishness. A man who walks in integrity lives in a manner consistent with the principles that he holds. And so if a man says, well, I believe we ought to be truthful. Well, if he's a man of integrity, his life is going to be controlled by that principle. Or if a man says, well, I think we ought to be pure in our conduct. Well, if he has any integrity, he's going to live in a manner consistent with that principle. Oh, let's just pursue this idea a little bit further. In the 19th Psalm, in verse 13, we read, also keep back your servant from presumptuous sins. Let them not rule over me, then I will be blameless. That's the idea, the same word. Then I will be blameless. And so keep me away from sin, then I'll be blameless and I shall be acquitted of great transgression. It's used of God in the Scriptures, this idea of being blameless or having integrity. In the 18th Psalm in verse 30, God's way is blameless. In the 19th Psalm, in verse 7, God's law is blameless. In Genesis chapter 6, in verse 9, there Noah is described as a blameless man. And it's associated in Noah's case with righteousness and the fact that he walked with God. And so it's a man who's righteous, he walks with God, he's blameless. Or he's a man of integrity, some versions might say. God instructs Abraham to develop this characteristic. Walk with me and be blameless, or develop integrity. Israel is told in Deuteronomy 18 and verse 13, you shall be blameless before the Lord. And David in the 78th Psalm in verse 72, shepherded according to the integrity of his heart. And so we're to be blameless or whole in our heart, without moral defect in our heart. And of course, that produces a behavior that's consistent with that. It occurs a number of times in the Psalms. For example, look at the 101st Psalm. The 101st Psalm and verse 2, and then a little bit later on in verse 6. I will give heed to the blameless way. And so, remember a moment ago we said that God's way is blameless, and so I'm going to give heed to, I'm going to pay attention to the blameless way so that I might live according to the blameless way. And then verse 6. My eyes shall come upon the faithful of the land, and they may dwell with me. He who walks in a blameless way is the one who will minister to me. And so, earlier in verse 5, whoever secretly slanders his neighbor, him will I destroy. No one who has a haughty look and an arrogant heart will I endure. But the one who walks in a blameless way is the one who will minister to me. He who practices deceit shall not dwell within my house. And the one who speaks falsehood shall not maintain his position before me. And so being blameless, or a person of integrity, is opposed to falsehood and deceit and pride and slander. So who will God accept? That's the question. Who is God going to allow to abide in his tent and to dwell on his holy hill? Well, the person who has integrity. The person who seeks God's law, who lives according to God's law, who avoids deceit and falsehood, who is sincere in his attempts to live according to God's law. And then the one who works righteousness. Now, this is an important word in the Old Testament. It occurs about 275 times in the Old Testament, this idea of righteousness. The idea of righteousness means to conform to God's standard of right and wrong. So to be righteous means that we conform to something. And in this case, conform to God's standard of right and wrong. So the 145th Psalm in verse 17 says, the Lord is righteous in all his ways and kind in all his deeds. The Lord is righteous in all his ways. So if we want to be righteous, well then we conform to God's standard of righteousness, since he's righteous in all his ways. When this particular word is used to describe our behavior and our attitude toward other people, there's a strong element of justice included. And so we practice justice with each other. And so look at Leviticus chapter 19. Where we find this word used man's dealing with other men, Israel's dealings with other Israelites. Leviticus 19 and verse 15. You shall do no injustice. There's our word in a negative way. You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor defer to the great, but you are to judge your neighbor fairly. Righteously. And so fair judgment. Now you don't benefit the poor. You don't benefit, you don't prejudicially favor the poor or the rich. You just judge the matter based on the facts and what people have done. You judge righteously. You render justice. All right, a little bit later, same chapter, Leviticus chapter 19, verse 36. You shall have just balances and weights. A just ephah, a just hen. I am the Lord your God who brought you out from the land of Egypt. And so a just system of measurements and weights. So that if someone comes and he wants to buy a pound of grain, and you put it, you have a something that weighs a pound on one side of the scales, and you weigh out the grain. Well, that if you say it weighs a pound, it weighs a pound. All right, it's just, it's fair. And so that's the idea. And so who might dwell in God's tent? Who may abide in His on His holy hill? People who practice justice. And so think about those two characteristics. You got, on the one hand, people that pursue integrity. They're developing integrity within themselves. And secondly, they practice justice. And then the third one, here in the 15th Psalm in verse 2, he speaks truth in his heart. Truthfulness is a fundamental characteristic of God, of course. He acts according to loving kindness and truth, Genesis 24 and verse 27. In the 25th Psalm in verse 5, the psalmist says, "Lead me in your truth." And in the 31st Psalm in verse 5, he's described as the God of truth. In this description in Exodus 34, that seems like we go back to over and over again, when God passes before Moses, remember God says, the Lord God, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in loving kindness and truth. Abounding in truth. So truth is a fundamental characteristic of God, and so it ought to be true of His people as well. Truth is what is consistent with the facts. And so if it's raining outside and I say, hey, it's raining, all right, I've told the truth. What I've said is consistent with the facts. But if I say it's raining outside and it's not raining, well, unless I'm mistaken, if I do that deliberately, of course, well, I've said something that is not true. And so a person who speaks truth in his heart is someone who seeks the truth. He identifies the truth. He holds to the truth. He's not deceived. He's not deceived by others. He doesn't allow others to deceive him into thinking something is true when it's not. Nor does he deceive himself. He doesn't allow his own desires to convince him that something is true when it's not. He's able to set aside his desires so that he might identify the truth and then hold to the truth. He's able to speak the truth in his heart, and so he's able then to speak the truth to others as well. Well, I got to thinking about this idea of truth. The truth can be dangerous, can't it? To speak the truth in your heart, that can be a dangerous thing. And it can be very uncomfortable as well, to speak the truth in one's heart. We live in a world in which people do not seek the truth or speak the truth. If the truth interferes with their desires, they're willing to hide the truth and avoid the truth, evade the truth, or cover the truth up in some way. Sometimes what they'll do is they'll, instead of calling a thing what it is and speaking the truth, well, they'll call it something that it's not. And in that way, they're not confronted by truth. They're able to avoid it and evade it. If you watch the news, it happens all the time. At least it seems to me to happen frequently on the news. Let me give you an illustration of what happens in our culture and our society. If there's a news story about abortion, you see, they don't want to deal with the uncomfortableness of the truth. And so they're not going to call abortion what it is. You know, the dismembering of an innocent baby, unborn. The killing of an innocent, unborn child. They're not going to call it the truth because they don't want to have to deal with the uncomfortable nature of the truth in that particular issue. And so they're going to evade it and avoid it and cover it up and describe it in inoffensive language so we don't have to deal with the uncomfortable truth of abortion. And so they'll call abortion a women's health issue. It's not a women's health issue. It's the killing of an innocent unborn child. Or they'll talk about those who oppose abortion as waging a war against women. Not waging a war. That's not true. That's not the truth. But people would rather conceal the truth in those kinds of terms rather than deal with the truth. And so, you see, a person who speaks truth in his heart, that's a courageous person, isn't it? He's able to deal with the uncomfortable nature of the truth, even when it reveals something that undesirable about himself, about the culture around him, about his relationship with God and things like that. We want the courage to seek the truth and hold to it. 23rd chapter of Proverbs in verse 23, buy the truth and sell it not. We want the courage to know the truth about ourselves. We might not like what we see, but we need the courage to see the truth about ourselves and speak the truth in our hearts, to see the truth about the world around us, and to see the truth about our relationship with God. These are impressive characteristics, aren't they? You know, God's standard is very high, isn't it? And so the question is, who may abide, O Lord, in your tent? Who may dwell on your holy hill? The person of integrity. The person who practices justice. And the person who seeks and speaks truth. That's a pretty high standard, isn't it? Are we seeking these things? Are we developing these things? Are these things of any concern to us? Or do we simply assume that, well, God will accept me. After all, I know all the words to the songs, you know. No, we need to be busy developing these characteristics. Well, look at the rest of the psalm. And we can divide these, we can kind of organize the rest of the psalm in these ways. There are three negatives, beginning in verse 3. The man that God will accept does not slander with his tongue. He does no evil to his neighbor. And he does not take up a reproach against his friend. So here are three negatives. All of these have to do with our relationship with others. Now that's interesting. That God will accept those who behave properly toward others. Not just those who act properly toward Him, in, for example, in worship, but those whose behavior is right and appropriate when it comes to their dealings with other people. First of all, he does not slander with his tongue. It's an interesting word. It's related to the word for feet. And so, and usually this word is used to describe a spy. A spy is somebody that goes into territory like, you remember the two spies that went in to spy out the land of Canaan? And so they go in and they walk about. They go about and they're looking for information that might help them take that territory. Well, here the idea is that the man that God accepts doesn't go about telling tales about his neighbor. Now, he doesn't go about gossiping. Remember Romans chapter 1, verse 29, there in that particular passage, Paul is describing the Gentile world that spiraled down and down, further and further away from God. They did not see fit to have God in their knowledge, and so God gave them over to a depraved mind to do those things that are not proper. Murder, strife, deceit, malice, they're gossips. And so the person that's acceptable to God is a person that doesn't slander with his tongue. He doesn't go around telling tales about his neighbor, especially when those tales are not true or call his character, his neighbor's character, into question. In other words, he controls his tongue. He's careful about what he says. He's careful about what he says about other people. He does no evil to his neighbor. That's a fairly general statement, pretty broad statement. And well, the Ten Commandments might help us fill in some details. What does he not do when he does not do evil to his neighbor? Well, he doesn't kill, steal, commit adultery, bear false witness, or covet what his neighbor has, and that would provide some detail. In the 13th chapter of the book of Romans, and beginning in verse 8, Paul says, owe nothing to anyone except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. For this, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet. And if there's any other commandment, it's summed up in this saying, love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Love is the fulfillment of the law. And so you do no evil, you do no wrong to your neighbor. Jesus says, on the other hand, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Matthew 7, verse 12. He doesn't take up a reproach against his friend. And so here, have the sort of the idea of gossiping or slandering a friend or a neighbor or a close companion or speaking inappropriately about others. He picks up on that idea again here in this line. He doesn't say what will damage his neighbor or harm his neighbor, bring disgrace or shame upon his neighbor. James warns us in James chapter 4 and verse 11, brethren, don't speak evil against each other. Don't speak evil or speak against your brethren. We need to be careful what we say about other people. We need to think about what we say before we say it. Maybe in times past, neighbors would gather at the fence in the backyard, and they would talk about the neighbor next door or the neighbor down the street. And then maybe we would call each other on the phone and we'd say, talk about our neighbors or somebody like that, people we know. We might drive home from church and talk about our brethren and how weird they are and things like that. Or, of course, you know what the vehicle is today. Get on Facebook. Hit send without thinking about what we're saying. I said something about this the other day, and if I keep on talking about it, you might get the idea I don't like Facebook too much. I know it can be a great tool. I know it can be wonderful if it's used appropriately. But when it's not used appropriately, we can do a lot of damage and widespread damage in a hurry. So we just need to be careful what we say, about others, what we say about each other. So in other words, he doesn't slander with his tongue. He does no evil to his neighbor. He doesn't take up a reproach against his friend. In other words, he's loyal. He's loyal to his friends. He's loyal to those who are close to him. And so look at these characteristics. Integrity, justice, truth, loyalty. Wow, that's a high standard, isn't it? And so those are the kinds of characteristics we need to develop if we want our life to be acceptable to God. Well, he continues, verse 4. Here's more detail. In whose eyes a reprobate is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord. We're going to put those two together. A reprobate is a worthless person or a vile person. One commentator says, the perpetual undertaker of evil. I thought that was a good description. What is a reprobate? The perpetual undertaker of evil. The person God accepts despises such people. And that's not to say that he hates them, or he has malice against them, or he is in the right to mistreat them in some way. The idea is that these people, and we recognize, that these people have nothing that we desire. And so this word is used to describe Goliath's attitude toward David. So when David comes out to fight Goliath, Goliath looks at him, and David has nothing in his arsenal that impresses Goliath. So he despised David. David's not strong. He doesn't have powerful weapons. He's not necessarily quick or fast. He's a youth. He's a shrimp compared to Goliath. He's just a lad. There's nothing that impresses Goliath. He doesn't have anything that Goliath would. I'd like to have that in my arsenal. And that's the way we look at people of the world. They have nothing that we want. They have nothing that impresses us. They have nothing that we desire. They're devoid of the spiritual qualities that we highly value, and so we turn away from them. On the other hand, we honor those who fear the Lord. Just make a few observations. This might have a good application to the people we choose to be our friends. So who are we going to choose? Here are people that are reprobate, they're vile, perpetual undertakers of evil. Are we going to have them as our friends, or are we going to choose as friends those who fear the Lord? Well, we need to choose those who fear the Lord, because they're going to help us fear the Lord and develop our relationship with God. It occurs to me that the world does the very opposite of this. This says, to be acceptable to God, what we need to do is despise the reprobate and honor those who fear the Lord. Well, the world does the opposite. The world despises those who fear the Lord, and they honor the reprobate. Well, just watch the Academy Awards. Well, watch the Grammys. And I think you'll see that my observation is accurate. The world gives its greatest admiration to those who rebel against godliness, the profane, the vulgar, the indecent, the immoral, the lascivious. All receive adulation from the world and their praise for their courage. Let me just illustrate it this way. You had Kim Davis up here in Kentucky. Remember, she's the county clerk that refused to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Now, I didn't see Diane Sawyer or Barbara Walters or Oprah sitting down with her and saying, how did you work up the courage? You know, that was such a courageous stand. To go to jail for your conviction. Well, that's an inspiration to all of us. Where did you get the courage to do that? I didn't see any of that. What I did see on the headlines online this afternoon was that Saturday Night Live has finally ridiculed Kim Davis in the manner that she deserves, and it was great. Now, you know, I don't know much about Kim Davis and her life. I'm just talking about this one conviction that she has that I find admirable. And yet the world despises that. On the other hand, you've got people praising, just falling all over themselves to praise Bruce Jenner because he has the courage and the money to pretend to be a woman. That's why he's saying he's a man. He'll never be a woman. He'll always be a man pretending to be a woman. And yet, look, you're so courageous. You're so inspirational. How did you summon the courage? I wrote an article back a few months ago, I guess, maybe a couple months ago. You know, courage to be immoral is not an admirable quality. You know, a person can summon up the courage to walk into a bank and say, stick them up, I want all your money. Well, that's courage, but we wouldn't dare sit down with him and say, where did you summon the courage? It's so admirable. Where did you summon the courage to rob that bank? Well, it takes some courage, no question about that. But courage to be immoral is not an admirable quality. A courage to do right. Yeah, now that is an admirable quality. Well, anyway, that's just a little commentary on our society, how we do the very opposite of what God accepts, in whose eyes a reprobate is despised, but who honor those who fear the Lord. He swears to his own herd and does not change. The idea is that he's true to his word, not only when things don't work out to his advantage, when things work out to his disadvantage. He's true to his word. Now that doesn't mean you can never change your mind or you can never, once you say, okay, I'll do this, go back and negotiate another agreement with somebody. I don't think he intends to say that. But when we commit ourselves to an agreement, he keeps it until the time is right for him to do something else. Jesus puts it this way, let your yes be yes and your no be no. So he swears to his own hurt and he doesn't change. He thinks he's getting, you know, a good deal when he makes this agreement, but it turns out to be his disadvantage. He doesn't quit on it just because it's to his disadvantage. He doesn't lend money with interest. Remember, the Jews were forbidden under the law of Moses to lend money with interest. And that was a way that they could help those who were in need. Only people in need would borrow money. And so here's a person who's in need. Okay, if you have the opportunity to help him, help him. And don't take advantage of his situation. And so let him borrow your money without interest. And so again, the general idea is that he doesn't take advantage of people. There may be situations in which we could take advantage of others for our own benefit. And so we devise a plan or, you know, we find out here's an opportunity. Now, it's not exactly illegal. It's not really dishonest. It's not really fair either. And so we take advantage of someone in that way. No, that's not what we ought to do. In Israel, they were to help each other. They were to be brothers and partners. And so they ought to deal with each other in a just and fair way and help one another. And so that's what we try to do. We're not trying to take advantage of each other. We're trying to help each other. And so that's the idea. He doesn't take a bribe against the innocent. The idea is similar to the previous one. A judge who takes a bribe against an innocent person enriches himself dishonestly at the expense of the condemned. I don't know that any of us will be in a situation where we could take a bribe against an innocent person as a judge may take a bribe. But again, we could take advantage of our position to maybe in an unfair way benefit at the expense of someone else. And so a person that takes a bribe against the innocent, he's unjust, the very opposite of what God desires. He has no integrity, no justice, and no truth. He's the very opposite of what God desires. And so here's a list of 10 behaviors, really. They spring forth from a certain kind of character, a person of integrity, a person who practices justice, a person who seeks the truth and holds to it when he finds it, a person who's loyal. It produces these kinds of behaviors. And then at the end he says, he who does these things will never be shaken. Now why is that? Well, it's because these things reflect the life. These behaviors that he talks about here reflects the life of a person who's committed to right behavior. I'm committed to doing what's right, even at my own expense. You know, I swear to my own hurt. And so even when it hurts me in some ways, I'm going to do what's right. And so here's a person who's committed to right behavior. He's dedicated to right attitudes and principles, truth and justice, and integrity and loyalty. He's committed to those things and he lives according to them. And he conscientiously puts them into practice. That's a man who will be right with God. That's a woman who will be right with God. And so there's the answer to the question. O Lord, who may abide in your tent? Who will you accept? Who's fit to come before your presence in worship? Well, it's this kind of person right here. James would say, be doers of the word. You know, most of these things have to do with doing something. And so be doers of the word and not hearers only. And so that's the kind of person that we want to, if we're that kind of person, we want to keep on being that kind of person. If we're not that kind of person yet, we want to become that kind of person. So that's a high standard for us indeed. If you're here tonight, not a Christian, we do want to give you an opportunity to become a Christian by believing on Jesus and repenting of your sins and being baptized. If you're already a Christian but not faithful, well, examine your life and having repented, ask God to forgive you. You can be right with Him. And if we can help you in some way, we invite you to come as we stand and sing together.